Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, June 12th. The future of public media hangs in the balance. House lawmakers just took a vote on funding this morning. We get the latest. Immigration fears are reverberating across the country. We learn about an organization providing resources for Micronesians in our community. And we take a closer look at the governor's intent to veto list. The state budget is on the chopping block. We learn more. And the United Nations Oceans Conference kicks off this week in Europe. We hear about new research showing how the steel industry affects international waters north of Hawaii. Plus, we turn the spotlight on a harpist who is retiring from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra after 44 years. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. House lawmakers have voted to cut funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. It was a narrow vote. And HPR's news director, Bill Dorman, has been monitoring the proceedings and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. 214 to 212, just about as close as it can be, because that's they needed a simple majority to pass this, and so they just barely got to that. And this is, again, it's the full House voting on this. Now it goes over to the Senate, so that is the next stage of this. The arguments throughout, the politics of this, have centered largely on the radio side around NPR, around PBS as well. But that through line to the impact on local stations is something that Democrats had been talking about on the floor in committee, and something that a number of Republicans have talked about. Because when you look over time, bipartisan support for public broadcasting has been there for years, although Republican administrations, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, both tried to cut out. This is as far as it has gotten in the debate that's gone on for years, but that's, you know, it's past the House now, and then on to the Senate next.
Do we know how long it might be before they schedule that?
So the Senate has a deadline of July 18th. They have to get it through by that time. They have not yet set a calendar. The House, actually, as Congress goes, the House is generally more specific. The Senate takes a little more freedom. They get a little more elbow room in setting their agenda. So we don't know right now when that's going to be happening. But certainly you can anticipate reaction coming. We already heard this morning Catherine Marr, the president's CEO of NPR, saying that if rescission does pass and local stations go dark, millions of Americans will no longer have access to locally owned independent nonprofit media, bear the risk of living in a news desert, missing emergency alerts, hearing silence where classical jazz and local artists currently play. Again, in the Senate, it has been thought to have public broadcasting has been thought to have more bipartisan support than in the House. But again, very close vote in the House, and we'll see what happens in the next round.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't bode well, but I guess we can keep fingers crossed that there'll be support there.
And that again, that impact on local stations, you hear a lot of politicking about NPR, but it's the local station and community impact that you hear both sides of the aisle.
Right, and a lot of those in very remote areas. But thank you so much, Bill.
You bet.
We've been talking to HPR's news director, Bill Dorman, who has been tracking developments on funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, as well as other spending items. Immigration raids are intensifying across the country, and so are protests opposing them. 700 Marines are arriving in Los Angeles, where the National Guard has already been deployed. Mayors and governors across the country are bracing for more unrest as nationwide No Kings protests are planned for this Saturday. Even immigrants with legal status are feeling uneasy as the Trump administration rolls back protections for those who have entered the country through programs such as temporary protected status. Here in Hawaii, one particularly vulnerable immigrant community is made up of those who are in the country as part of COFA. That's the Compact of Free Association, an arrangement between the U.S. and island nations throughout Micronesia that gives citizens of those countries permission to live and work in the U.S. in exchange for a U.S. military presence in their homelands. Last year, those in the U.S. under this unique arrangement were given access to federal benefits, including Social Security, food, and education assistance, as well as FEMA disaster relief. An estimated 20 to 30,000 Pacific immigrants are living in Hawaii legally under COFA. Austin Haleopi is a part of the Micronesian community. He recently helped to launch COFA CAN, an organizing and advocacy group for COFA immigrants. Haleopi spoke with the conversation's D.W. Gibson, beginning with a quick explainer on COFA.
In a nutshell, COFA stands for the Compact of Free Association, and that is the agreement between the U.S. and three countries in the Micronesian region, namely the Republic of Palau, the Federated States of Micronesia, and the Republic of the Marshall Islands. That document allows citizens from these countries to travel to and from the United States without the need of a visa or a green card, just their passport, I-94, which they get when they get here. And then, yeah, they are able to work here, live here, go to school. They're eligible for different federal programs. It's a interesting, different, unique category of status that we have in the United States.
Why does now feel like a good time to reinvigorate this effort with COFA CAN?
There's a lot of great orgs that are already doing advocacy work on the grassroots level. And so I just really think COFA can be that broader organization that fills in the spaces where we're needed. And so recently, with everything that's been going on with the different immigration policies that's been coming down from the federal level, we just have been really working on making sure that our COFA communities are informed to the best that we can.
So what is some of the information that you feel is most critical to get to the communities you work with? What do you want them to know?
I think first and foremost, I want them to know that they are here legally, that they do have rights, just like anybody else in this country. I want them to know that it is a good idea to keep their documents in order and updated, making sure that they know where they are, if they need to access them for anything. And I want everybody to know what the resources are specific to their situations, if they need to seek help for anything or assistance. I want them to be able to know who to call, especially like the professionals in these different fields.
Lawyers and so forth.
Lawyers, clinics, yeah, any kind of legal representation, so that if they are, for whatever reason, caught in a situation where they do need help, they have places or they have people to call. I'm not an immigration lawyer, but we try to make sure that we vet our information before we put it out there and that we make our information specific to the unique status of our COFA community. We just want to make sure that our communities are prepared for as much as we can prepare them for.
Well, and people who are here under the COFA agreement, as you said, are here legally. They have status here. But there seems to be a prevailing sense of precarity, too, a sense of being vulnerable to some of the immigration actions on the part of the federal government. Talk about those vulnerabilities.
I think there's a general fear in our communities, because I think a lot of us were hoping that this would be a time where our status kept us safe, at least feeling safe. But in the recent happenings, it seems like we're being lumped in with just a general immigrant community, which isn't such a bad thing. But when we're talking about as far as things that are coming down from the federal level, again, we have our unique status. And so it just brings me back to wanting to make sure that our communities are informed and that they're not graying the lines, comparing our statuses to other folks and their statuses.
We're certainly living in an era of hyper enforcement when it comes to immigration. And as you said, COFA citizens are here legally, but there are probably some vulnerabilities in terms of any interaction with law enforcement, criminal records, those kinds of things. Are those elements that you're aware of that could jeopardize a person's status?
Yeah, for sure. Criminal records being, of course, one of the main ones. There's not a fine line to identify the crimes that make folks deportable. So we just make sure that our communities know that if they do have a record, that they try to take precaution when they travel or stuff like that. Just because it seems, especially in seeing some of the raids happening, it seems like there's no real protocol to it all. It seems like they're just going after whoever they feel that is not supposed to be here, which is, it doesn't really make our work easier. But yeah, those are some of the things that could put their status in jeopardy. So those are some of the things that we try to address when we give webinars about Know Your Rights and safe spaces and stuff like that.
Are there immigration actions that have taken place here in the islands within COFA communities or on the continent that you're aware of?
There are some that I've heard of. I don't want to speak on those just because I haven't seen it.
You've spoken about how COFA CAN works to get good information out to the communities. Is there bad information that's circulating? And talk about that bad information.
I think there's always bad information when, especially in the world of social media now, day and age where you can pretty much share whatever at the press of a button. As a community, we're new to that, having that kind of access coming from our islands. We're the same people every day and you get what comes in. To having access to everything and wanting to know everything, wanting to get everything, it gets to a point where it just confuses everybody. And so what we try to do, especially with social media, is making sure that we try to break the algorithm so that at least the content that we push out there, we know for sure that it's accurate and it's something for our community.
I know you've been working to get Know Your Rights cards out there. Tell us about those. And a lot of organizations provide such tools, but it seems like it's important to make sure that Know Your Rights cards specific for the COFA community get out there.
Yeah, again, it goes with our status. It's just ever since I've been growing up and just watching my family struggle with having to do something as simple as renew their license. With everything happening, we just want to make sure that we do have something that's specific for our communities, because these other materials, as good as they are for the communities that they're for, some of those things don't necessarily pertain to us. So that was one of our first projects in refounding COFA CAN, just putting that out there, just knowing that the need is there and making sure, again, our communities are informed.
When you talked about COFA CAN working across issues pertaining to the COFA communities in the islands, and we've been talking mainly about immigration, but there was another story that came up recently that relates back to COVID, and that has to do with reimbursement for burial expenses for those who died during the pandemic. We know that deaths in Hawaii were disproportionately within the Micronesian communities, and the city and county of Honolulu launched an assistance program to finally give COFA families money for those burials. Certainly, it's a tardy action, but does it seem adequate in terms of the steps that the city and county has taken at this stage?
I think it is adequate. It's interesting living here because there's so many different communities that are trying to vie for the same resources and resources that are limited. And so I understand the frustration. But again, it just goes back to being informed. Because I think what a lot of folks didn't know is that, yeah, COFA communities weren't eligible for those funds like everybody else was during that time. Even in the Lahaina fires, FEMA had to reopen again just for the COFA citizens. And there's a lot of people that didn't understand why when the deadline had passed already. But they also didn't realize that there were COFA communities that lived in Lahaina that also were affected, but they weren't eligible for FEMA because of the confusion of their status. It's interesting time that the city and county of Honolulu wants to bring it back, but I am glad that it's happening because as tardy as it is, I think that for those families that really need it, it's going to go a long way. And yeah, hopefully that just creates more awareness around the specificity of our status, and so that when things like that happen again, we won't have to wait however many years before we're able to get what everybody else had received.
Is there anything else that I haven't asked you about that you think is important to communicate to COFA communities, or anything that's important for anyone not in a COFA community to understand about the challenges faced by the communities in Hawaii?
Oh, man. I don't know if we have enough tape for that. I don't know if we have time for that.
That long list in your mind right now, what are the top items that really come to mind?
At the end of the day, like I said, there's a lot of different circumstances that led our communities to here in Hawaii specifically. And unfortunately, those circumstances are also what's oppressing our communities now, not just our COFA communities, but other communities that are also vying for the same resources and help. So I think what I would like to say to listeners is just really take a step back and just think about your own story, your own migration story and how you got here. Think about your family's history. It's not so far off when we compare it to other stories of immigrants, especially here in Hawaii. I think when we break it all down, we're all just trying to live and make our respective communities better and make our living conditions better. And speaking as a dad, that's just a different whole set of priorities that has pushed me to the work that I do.
That was Austin Haleopi speaking with HPR's G.W. Gibson about concerns in the COFA community about the immigration raids on the mainland. For more information on COFA Can, check out our website at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
Today on The Daily, California's governor, Gavin Newsom, says that President Trump's decision to send federal troops into Los Angeles is a, quote, brazen abuse of power, and a defining moment for the Democratic Party and American democracy. I'm Mike Barbaro. That's today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, Ohana, working to protect and manage Oahu's water resources since 1929 for fresh water now and for future generations. BoardofWaterSupply.com.
Governor Josh Green has until July 9th to veto bills passed by state lawmakers. He released his potential veto list before a trip back to the nation's capital. Here with more on this is HPR's government reporter Ashley Mizuo. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, you know, and one of the things on the list was the state budget, but we really don't know what he might be vetoing, what line item issues, right?
Right, exactly. So even though the state budget is on there as a potential veto, that doesn't mean he's going to veto the whole thing, right? It's line items, particular things on there. However, as you said, we don't really know exactly what those are going to be. And the kind of reasoning for that was, Governor Green is going to be in D.C. and then I think also on a family vacation late into the end of June. And that would put him past the deadline to put out the veto notice, basically. And so because of that, I think they're still working out some of the details when it comes to what line items exactly they're going to be vetoing or consider vetoing. Yeah.
Yeah. So I imagine for groups who maybe thought they had things, cleared in the budget, they don't know.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people who are probably still concerned, watching, listening, trying to think about what this might mean. I know that House and Senate leadership have been meeting towards the end of this week, or will be meeting this week, to kind of discuss some of these items on the veto list, as well as I'm sure things they might think might be line item vetoed out of the budget. And, a lot of the things that are driving this potentially vetoing things in the budget is because the Council on Revenues did come out right after the legislative session with a lower projected revenue for the state, and that heavily influences obviously what can be put in the budget. So that reduced revenue is one thing, and then also just watching to see what happens when it comes to cuts in federal funding.
Right. Yeah, because if we have less money that we're collecting in our tax coffers, there's less money to spend.
Exactly. And, you know, just because, though, there are like a bunch of bills on this list, there are 19, that doesn't necessarily mean that Governor Green will be vetoing all of these bills. He just has to notify the legislature by June 24th, of course, that he is considering vetoing it so that they can kind of make their own plans about whether or not they would like to come back and override his veto on any of these particular measures with a two-thirds majority. Besides the budget, there are a bunch of other different types of bills on here. One of the kind of areas that we're looking at is criminal justice bills. There was a bill that passed regarding the asset forfeiture program, which is when law enforcement can seize property to investigate crimes if they think it's been used, or if they think it's been used for illegal activity, even if no one has actually been charged. So lawmakers passed a bill that would have required law enforcement to return the seized property to someone who has not been charged with the crime after a year. As I said before, seized property can be forfeited even if no charges are brought against the owner. And the bill that they had passed also established better reporting requirements for the Attorney General's office, which have kind of been deficient. And the Attorney General has acknowledged this kind of like lapse in data reporting. But Green wrote that the one-year restriction is actually not enough time for law enforcement to file charges, and that forfeited property is really important to investigations. House Judiciary and Hawaiian Affairs Committee Chair David Tarnas explained that if the measure is vetoed by the governor, he will continue to work on it next year.
The reports that the Attorney General submits to the legislature on the asset forfeiture program have really been deficient. And the Attorney General herself has acknowledged that, and she said they will do a better job. And I will continue working on this with Senator Rhodes to come up with a bill that we can get supported by the administration. I'm not going to advocate to have the legislature override the governor's veto. I'm a very collaborative kind of legislator who works in a facilitative manner to come up with a solution that everyone can agree to. We did suggest in our bill that the assets would only be able to be forfeited once an individual is charged. And so hopefully we'll be able to stay with that as the trigger, but we would extend the time. So rather than just being 1 year, maybe 2 years will be sufficient. But we'll have to work on this and see if that's going to be the right combination of things so we can have reform.
And, you know, another measure being considered by Green for veto would have set stronger regulations on the use of, well, what they're calling is restrictive housing, but really it's solitary confinement on inmates within who are incarcerated. Kat Brady, the coordinator of the Community Alliance on Prisons, has been fighting for reform of the state's use of solitary confinement for the last decade.
Isolation with absolutely no programs, no books, nothing. You're thrown in a cell, you know, with a little thin mattress on the floor, and you have nothing. And maybe you get out for 1 hour a day. And it's like humans are social creatures. And to isolate people is just, it's so inhumane.
She and other advocates were really concerned that solitary confinement has and will continue to drive people to take their own lives in the prison system here in Hawaii. And a 2021 report showed that 245 inmates in Hawaii were put in solitary confinement and that 97 of them were kept there for over a year.
That's a long time.
Yeah. Green wrote to the Department of the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation has policies in place and follows national standards. And he added that the department is going to be working with the Correctional Oversights Commission to amend its policies and procedures. But in written testimony for the measure, the Correctional Oversight Commission actually supported the bill and wrote that they were concerned about the current operations at the Department of Corrections regarding solitary confinement. Moving past criminal justice bills, there were also three housing bills that were on this list. I spoke with Senate Housing Chair Stanley Chang, who was surprised by these choices considering Governor Green's aggressive stance on housing.
This governor has emphasized that housing is his top priority, and he's been a leader in many aspects of the housing production system here in Hawaii. And so these are some of the best bills we've passed this year to improve and streamline the housing production system.
So there are three different bills on the veto list, intent to veto list. One would have made counties unable to put more income restrictions or reduce fee waivers that would increase the cost of an affordable housing project. So that's when, you know, like county councils come back and change projects or tell projects, like, in order to be built, you must do these XYZ things. Counties opposed to this bill because they say it'll make it harder to make projects fit the needs for their communities. Another one would have created an expedited permitting process for single-family and multifamily homes, where if a building permit is not reviewed within 60 days, then it would be granted if it's certified by an architect and an engineer. This is, of course, too, because of the long wait periods people are seeing when they're trying to fix their homes and get permits from the different planning departments across the state.
Yeah, there's been a backlog.
Yes,
yeah.
A backlog. And DPP did testify against this measure and said that not having proper review could result in bad builds. And I will say DPP has been implementing many different things to try to cut down on this these wait times, but it's still a very long time for many of these permits to come through. Another one would take old properties out of the state historic preservation review program if they are in areas that are known to not have iwi kupuna or other historical artifacts. And that's also meant to alleviate the amount of projects going through review. And this was supported by the Department of Land and Natural Resources, which the State Historic Preservation Division is under. But Green was concerned, of course, about, you know, possibly missing some of these artifacts or iwi kupuna if we take these properties out of review.
Yeah, I mean, because the problem is there are a lot of buildings that are more than 50 years old, and that's an awful lot of stuff to review.
Right, but there is also a backlog there, right? And so it's talking about trying to streamline these programs to get these properties reviewed, but also weighing, you know, the preservation aspects of things as well.
Right, trying to be fair, and yet I know they're shorthanded, so it's a tough situation to be in.
Yeah, exactly. And then the last bill is about tax credits. There was a bill that would have, you know, really reduced tax credits offered by the state for film, for renewable energy, and that's also on the intent to veto list. But again, none of this is set in stone. Governor could choose not to veto any of these measures. It's just an alert.
And he's coming back
I believe on
deadline.
June 24th.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see what happens. But thank you so much, Ashley.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from HPR's government reporter, Ashley Mizzou. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha Air Cargo, offering 5 direct flights weekly from Honolulu to Seattle Tacoma Airport. More information at AlohaAirCargo.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Benicio del Toro talks about his leading role in Wes Anderson's new film, The Phoenician Scheme. He'll look back on his film career and tell us about losing his mother when he was 9 and moving from Puerto Rico to Pennsylvania in his teens. Del Toro's other films and TV series include The Usual Suspects, Sicario, and Escape from Dannemora. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership, providing full-service wealth management on Oahu, Maui, and throughout California. Learn more at thericepartnership.com.
You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The United Nations Ocean Conference kicked off in France this week, with scientists watching to see if the international community would ratify a treaty to protect the open ocean. 50 countries have signed on to the High Seas Treaty. 60 are needed for the first legally binding agreement protecting marine life in international waters to take effect. The U.S. has not ratified the treaty. A region of international importance that would fall under the treaty is the North Pacific Transition Zone. It's a patch of ocean north of Hawaii that hosts fish and other aquatic species. New research from the University of Hawaii at Manoa reveals that pollution from the steel industry has affected this region's delicate ecosystem. Nick Hako is an assistant professor of oceanography at UH Manoa who led the research. He spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about his team's new work.
The ocean itself is, you know, this vast part of our planet that provides us endless ecosystem services. I mean, we know about the fish that we eat, and those are all caught from the ocean, but there's also these enormous like carbon capture capabilities that are part of our planet, right? The ocean absorbs so much of the carbon that we're putting in through global climate change, but it's also what kept our planet habitable for millions of years. And it's all sort of comes down to the chemistry of the ocean and then the plankton that live there. So plankton basically live and die every single day. So they grow, they fix carbon from the atmosphere. So they take up carbon dioxide, convert that into their biomass and create this biomass that then provides the basis of the food chain. And some fraction of their biomass ends up sinking to the deep ocean. And because that's carbon, right? It was originally carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That ends up being this big pump, this biological pump that takes carbon from the atmosphere and stores it into the deep ocean. So this is one of the reasons why we have had stable CO2 levels for thousands of years prior to the Industrial Revolution, is because of the ocean plankton keeping everything habitable for us.
And how does that cycle get thrown out of whack? Like, how did the Industrial Revolution start to do that in the ocean?
Yeah. So just for a little bit more context, one of the things we know about ocean plankton is that they're basically maxing out their ecosystem. So they're operating almost at full capacity, given the amount of nutrients that the environment provides to them. And one of the things that's cool is that the nutrients that end up limiting an ecosystem are actually different region to region. So around Hawaii, we're in this big swirling North Pacific gyre. All the plankton there are sort of totally optimized to take up these tiny quantities of nitrogen to build their proteins, to build their DNA, to build their cells. And so they try to do that. But actually, when you go further north, when you head closer to Alaska, there's tons of nitrogen there, but there's not that much more plankton. And the key there is that they've, despite having this resource of nitrogen, they don't have enough of another resource of iron. And iron is really sort of the secret sauce for photosynthesis. You need iron to sort of pass electrons around in order to take CO2 and turn it into organic carbon, into biomass. And so those regions are iron deficient. And so if you were to add iron to those regions, you would create a big plankton bloom. For decades, oceanographers thought that the big source of iron to the ocean was dust deposition. So over in the Gobi Desert out in Asia, dust storms come in, they kick up all this dust that gets blown out to the Pacific. Some of it falls to the ocean, and then that's the source of iron for plankton. But over the last couple decades, you know, there's been so much industrial growth, so much coal combustion, and especially steel making. And what's become clear is that those processes, those human processes, are adding to the natural supply of iron. And because iron is this limiting nutrient to the ecosystem, they're starting to change this ecological balance of what nutrient is limiting this ecosystem.
So in this most recent study, with respect to iron and phytoplankton, what were you trying to figure out?
So we were investigating this region called the North Pacific Transition Zone, and this is sort of halfway between the nitrogen-limited gyre around Hawaii and the sort of iron-limited gyre around Alaska. If you think about it, it's sort of this Goldilocks zone where you're providing iron from one region and nitrogen from another region, and you should have this gangbusters productivity. And that's what's been observed, and this is actually a hotspot for Hawaii's fisheries in particular. So we knew that this region was really special because it was supporting all this ocean life. And what was unexpected was that a lot of the iron that was coming to this ecosystem was from humans and not from natural processes like desert dust.
Yeah. And so in this zone, you found that over the past 25 years, even, the iron that is seeping into the ocean has produced a bloom in phytoplankton. So unpack that for us. How much are we talking, and like how extreme is that?
Yeah. So every year, this part of the ocean experiences what oceanographers like to call a spring bloom. So spring comes around, there's light that comes on the ocean warms up a little bit. There's all these nutrients there, all this nitrogen that the plankton really want to eat up, and there's this natural source of iron. So everything is just right in this North Pacific Transition Zone region for the plankton to just go crazy. right? And so for this project, we had four opportunities to sail across this transition zone at different times of the year. And so we were able to stitch together the seasonal cycle here. This is super remote. We're on really advanced research vessels that are hard to get time on. So this is sort of cutting edge in terms of what we're able to do in terms of stitching together how this ecosystem works from going there and taking water samples and actually studying it in situ. But what's happening here is that there's this extra iron supply that humans are providing, and that's allowing the plankton to sort of burn through their other supply of nutrients faster. So they have this nitrogen that they've gotten through all the, you know, intense storm activity through the winter, right? They had this surplus of nitrogen, and they're just able to take that up way faster now than they could in the past. And what's the result of that is that there's a summertime period where there's not that much plankton because all the nutrients are stripped out. So the nutrients get stripped out, the ecosystem can't support that much plankton during the summer, and then that just lasts until the winter. And we think that transition point between this really rich spring bloom and then this really desert-like summer is happening earlier and earlier every year because of this anthropogenic iron source.
So you have like these boom and bust cycles, basically.
Exactly.
Give us a sense, is that a bad thing? Because some of these words together, like iron pollution, that sounds bad. Even like anthropogenic, man-made, takes on a negative connotation. So do you think of the results as this is a bad thing that is going on?
Yeah. So I think if you were to pull the plankton growing in the waters, they would say, well, I have more of what I needed, so I'm pretty happy about that. But the problem is that plankton aren't necessarily the best planners for what's going to happen 6 months from now. And so them doing this self-interested action of taking up the iron that's available and taking up the nitrogen that's available, it leads this ecosystem to have lower productivity in the summer. It sort of becomes more quiet, less productive. And so I think for the plankton in growing in the summer, they would say, well, that's a bad thing. I wish I had more nutrients around and I would grow more if I could. It's hard to balance those two interests, right? How do we sort of take a poll of all the millions of plankton that are in every bottle of seawater and ask them, you know, which way would they want the ocean to be? It's tough. But one of the things that we do know is that this net effect is sort of causing a northward shift in these ecosystem boundaries. So that boundary between the sort of low nutrient, oligotrophic gyre that has basically low productivity, low chlorophyll, a lot less life than further north, that boundary seems to be moving forward. And that's a shift that we're also expecting to see with climate change. The cause is different for climate change. It's related to the fact that the oceans are getting warmer. And so that the warm waters are just have less nitrogen. They're harder to mix with the deep ocean. And so they get less and less nitrogen every year. So what we have are these two processes that are shifting these ecosystem boundaries further north. One of the impacts that may lead to is that for people leaving out of Hawaii to go fishing in this area, they may have to go further north to reach the same biome that they had been fishing, you know, 20 years ago or so. And so you think that might be more fuel costs. It might be that they're not able to do it if they don't have the right boat to go further and further north. So there may be sort of human impacts that result from these ecosystem shifts.
But then for, I guess, interventions or causes, it's not necessarily easy to disentangle how the iron is getting there in the first place and what to do to stop it.
Yeah, I mean, from one perspective, this problem might be easier to address than something like global climate change, which is so core to human society that it becomes this existential problem. For these iron pollution, it's really only a couple sectors of steelmaking and coal combustion, which could probably be cleaned up through just application of existing technologies that could reduce the pollution out to the environment. So in some ways, this might be something that can be addressed sooner and then could slow that northward migration that would be this result of both iron input and climate change. And then we would have more time to sort of address this northward shift.
And I guess all it takes is for the producers to be incentivized to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, right now, so last century, most of the steel that was being produced in the US and Europe. And so you think about if assuming that was leading to a similar level of iron pollution, that was probably mostly happening in the Atlantic. In the last 50 years or so, that shifted over to Asia. And so what it really would take is international cooperation to highlight this as an important problem that is affecting this part of the ocean that there's no country is in charge of, right? These are international waters, but these are waters where tons of nations go to fish. So this is sort of our shared resource. And so if we want this to stay the same, to not be shifting northward several degrees every few decades, then we need to think about how we can work cooperatively to reduce the pollution.
Do you feel like as a researcher, you like combining this chemistry with almost the global history aspect?
Yeah, I mean, the reason I got into oceanography in the first place, because it was so obvious that everything was totally connected, and there was this universal currency of chemistry. So I was trained as a chemist, and so I learned to love, you know, molecules, which are kind of just like little Legos that all stitch together and work together in different ways. But most of the time when I was taking classes, it's you're looking at really specific examples, everything is happening in a test tube, and then you go outside and you have this whole world and you can't really explain much of it. So my journey as a oceanographer was really the excitement of being able to sort of connect to the fact that there are certain types of reactions that humans do because they generate products that we want. So making steel is a good example of that. And if that leads to certain types of pollution, that can impact the ecosystem because of these shared chemical currencies. And one of the things that is I've always found fascinating is that this problem of low iron is not just a problem for plankton out in the open ocean. This is a major driver of human health. Like when you get infected by bacteria, there's this big arms race that's happening basically in your body for the limited resource of iron. This is something that impacts, you know, how well you can grow wine in certain regions. This is something that just has this global effect because the chemistry of this is so challenging, and all of life is sort of trying to find ways to deal with this really reactive substance, iron, and handle it better and access more reservoirs of it. So here we have one example of the plankton trying to do their best to access iron, and they're getting a little bit of leg up from this sort of new human pollution source.
That was University of Hawaii at Manoa oceanographer Nick Hako talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. They were discussing new research into the North Pacific Transition Zone. Hako spent months aboard the Kilauea research vessel observing the open ocean and charting the growth of plankton. We'll have a link to the research on our website after the show. Connie Uejo is a principal harpist for the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra. She dropped by our studios this morning to talk with us, and she'll be honored at the Symphony Orchestra concert this Sunday for her unwavering commitment to her craft, her instrument. She owns about a half a dozen harps. All have names, and the ladies she considers her dear friends.
The original double-action pedal harp was invented in 1810 by a Frenchman, and it was a little bit smaller harp, easier to manage. But as we played in bigger rooms, bigger theaters, we needed to produce a bigger sound without being mic'd. The harps have gotten bigger soundboards and therefore taller to support the bigger soundboard.
And so tell me about the harp that you have that you play.
So the harp that I usually use with the orchestra is a Lyon & Healy made in Chicago. They call it Model 23. And I got that harp about 48 years ago.
Wow.
So she has served me well. One of the issues that we have now is that we are not in the hall like we used to be. I used to move the harp into the hall in September and take it out in May. And then I'd use another harp owned by the orchestra for the runouts and things like that. But now we're in and out of Hawaii Theater. We're in and out of other places to rehearse. We're in and out of the concert hall once in a while. But then it was shut down, closed, for a couple of years, and that's going to happen again. It's just a lot to move a 90-pound instrument out of the house, into the van, out of the van, into the concert hall or wherever we are.
Yeah, and it's a bit of an ordeal.
It is a bit of an ordeal, yeah. My husband and I are tired.
I don't blame you. It is a large instrument.
Yes, and it's always that unknown, who you're going to bump into on the street. We're trying to unload at Hawaii Theater. We'd have to block traffic, and somebody wants to come and help, quote unquote, but their help sometimes is a danger. So we really want to just do it ourselves.
Because you...
We know.
You know the ins and outs. And, yes. Yeah. Talk about your first harp.
My first harp. I wanted to play harp when I was very little, about 2-3 years old. But the ruling idea at that time was that harpists had to have a piano background because the music looked similar. You learned your keys and your sharps and flats. And so it aided the harp teacher's work if the little student learning already understood about piano music. So my teacher in Allentown had the requirement of 5 years of piano. So I started in second grade, and my parents kept telling me, we can't afford a harp, we can't afford a harp. Although they're the ones that started the interest, right?
Yes.
But they didn't realize how expensive it would be. And lessons were expensive, too. Eventually, in seventh grade, they cashed in their insurance policies and bought this harp at the Lion and Healy Salon in New York City that was in pieces.
Wow.
They took my dad in the back room, showed it to him, and he was very mechanically minded. And he could see the potential, even though they're like 2,000 moving parts. He could visualize what they were trying to do and rejuvenating. This harp was built in 1920. Then that Christmas, there was a harp next to the Christmas tree.
Oh, my gosh.
And I started lessons with my teacher in January. So.
Wow. Do you remember that morning when you
I remember
down?
Going to Allentown, how excited I was. It was about an hour away. There was no teacher in Reading at the time. And I was very excited. And she had music for me, books, beginning books. And at that time, we went every week just so I wouldn't get any bad habits. But eventually, it became very wearing every week to travel that distance. So she agreed, since I was doing well, to give me a double lesson every other week.
Wow.
So we went every other week, and I had an hour and a half lesson.
But that just helped to nurture your passion for this harp.
She had been in touch with my parents before they bought the harp, and so she encouraged them to take the risk that if I really wanted it, I would get scholarships to school and I would be able to earn money to help out with the finances. Because in addition to just buying the instrument, we have to keep it in strings. And strings are rather expensive too. They were right. She was right. I got a full tuition scholarship to Eastman School of Music. And I worked my way through school with extra gigs, or if an orchestra called Eastman and said, we need a harpist for the Brockport Orchestra. Do you have somebody to send? I would go and get paid. So it was financially a good idea for Mother and Daddy to do that, but risky.
Yeah, but do you remember, though, coming down and seeing that harp under the tree?
I remember. Our dog was very excited about it because it was this big thing in the living room. And once I started practicing, she would just be underneath the bench right by the back of the harp. And she'd stay there the whole time I was practicing.
It has such an angelic sound.
I think it's soothing even to the dogs. It's a soothing sound. And because we rest the harp on our chests and on our knees, we really feel those vibrations that we're making, and it is soothing.
And gosh, as your career then with the Honolulu Symphony Orchestra draws to a close this year, you're still going to teach?
I am going to play, yeah. I'm just not doing symphony, opera, and ballet. Those are the three biggies in what I have to prepare for. And I'll do the funerals at church or at the mortuary or wherever it's called for. I've done a variety of places. And weddings and parties. Just did a graduation party the other week. So that was very nice. Yeah, because it is quieter music. Sometimes they don't want the pumping bass. They want it more quiet. So.
Yeah, chamber music.
Yeah, chamber music for one.
I think just the love of music is just a wonderful gift that we can give our children. You give them a gift for life.
I think that's true. And I know that was a big part of the symphony program in the past. We had an education director. And at one point, we would have, in a season, 100,000 kids coming in and out of the concert hall for youth concerts. And we traveled to the neighbor islands and did concerts there. Big Island, we did like residencies 2 times a year. So that's difficult since we don't have the funding that we used to have anymore. But a lot of the kids don't have music in their schools either. So they're really missing that music input.
And your children got your love for music.
I'm afraid they did. Our daughter, Rebecca, is our oldest, and she plays piano, and she has played harp and organ, but piano is her main instrument, and she's a public school music teacher in Modesto, California. Our son, Stephen, played trumpet for several years at Iolani School, but then when he left Iolani, he retired the trumpet.
Okay.
And Kirk played clarinet for several years at Epiphany School and at Iolani. But then I think sports took a little bit more of an interest for him, but they still appreciate the music and enjoy coming to concerts. And they were listening to me practice in utero. So for their whole lives, they've been used to hearing music.
So do you still have that original harp?
I do, although she's had to have some work done on it through no fault of my own. when I was at Eastman, it was shipped to a job, and I didn't know it at the time, but they had dropped it off the back of the truck.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, if you mark fragile on something, that's the first thing they'll drop. So I didn't know it. I didn't see damage. But about 4 days later, the curved part of the harp just broke off down.
Like a stress fracture.
It was. That's goodness. What happens, like a delayed reaction. Sometimes it's immediate, but that was delayed. So it had to go back to the factory and have major work done. But that initial thing that happened in the 70s is still affecting her now. The sinking of the column into the base, and she's still struggling with that to this day. But she's got a new neck and a new board. I use her a lot, and she's out and about with me because she is the first harp I ever had.
Yes, you have. I'm sentimental.
I'm very sentimental, and she's very easy for me to play, and she has a beautiful sound, and so that's everything I could ask for.
Yeah, and gosh, as you prepare to hang it up with the Honolulu Symphony Orchestra, I don't know, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, my mother is in Reading, Pennsylvania. It's about an hour away. Actually, we're making an emergency trip on Tuesday. She's 97.
Oh, my gosh.
And struggling with a few issues. So our children have each been there in the last month to visit and help. Because of the symphony schedule, I didn't feel that I could go at that point, but they went, so that was an amazing thing. And Glenn and I can go Tuesday. Yeah. We'll be there about a week. Then I have to come back because there's more symphony work.
Yeah, I don't know when you told your mom about you hanging it up with the symphony. The fact that your whole career has been built around this instrument, that they sacrifice so much.
And my whole schedule has been built around the symphony schedule. So any trip to Pennsylvania or any family trip that we did when the kids were young, they were 1, 3, and 5 when I auditioned for the orchestra. There were a lot of adjustments for the family as I had that schedule that was not wavering. I had to be there. The harp had to be there. Yeah. Sometimes I missed basketball games, baseball games, piano programs, school concerts, but that's what has to happen.
So does your mom have a favorite song that you play for her on the harp?
Yeah, mother and dad both like specific pieces that I played, and I do play that. I have played that for her in the past. There's not going to be a harp there this year. I don't have a harp in Pennsylvania anymore. She can imagine it on a recording or something. Yeah.
But that just must be so meaningful, knowing that they help nurture this little spark.
I think it has been very meaningful to them, and that's why I know she and Dad. Dad passed away around 11 years ago. They would have wanted me to see this 44th season through. After all the years of work and effort that went into it, they wouldn't have wanted me to go to Pennsylvania. So, yeah, but now I will have more freedom in my traveling because I can go to Pennsylvania anytime but winter. We're really not interested in driving in the snow and ice anymore.
Yeah, we certainly thank you for what you've done for our music community over the years.
It's been a pleasure, really. When I look back at all these years of the commitment I made to the orchestra and the commitment that my husband made to making it possible so I could have the time to practice. He'd take care of the children so I could practice. It was a huge commitment for everybody, and I'm so appreciative, but I wouldn't change anything about it.
All right. Thank you so much for your time and for what you've done for our community.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been hearing from Connie Uwejio, who is retiring from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra after 44 years. Well, that is it for us today. Up tomorrow, we plan to get the latest on funding cuts at the University of Hawaii from its newly appointed interim provost. Got feedback for us? Call or talk back line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.